If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
So obviously we're looking at Human Rights Day, 9 minutes after nine, and we've asked Sheldon to come and serenade us with all the music that make us reflect on Human Rights Day. Hello, Sheldon.
Hi, how are you doing?
We are so happy to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here.
So, I mean, you couldn't have started with anybody better than
Bob Marley. Yeah.
Around the world, he's known to be the guy that fights for all of our rights musically.
Exactly. And I think Bob Marley is such an interesting character because it was at a time where, I mean, the reason why he even got his recording contract is because Chris Blackwell, who's the guy who signed him to Island Records, was at the time looking for like a Jimi Hendrix kind of like rock star character. And Bob Marley, when he walked into the offices to have a meeting with Chris Blackwell, it was like, this is the guy. I mean, he's got the persona, the charisma, he's got all of that stuff. But Bob Marley, other than being a phenomenal musician and innovator, he was someone who believed in fighting for people's rights. And so many songs that he wrote had that theme in mind. I mean, like Buffalo Soldier was was about African American soldiers who were fighting in the 1800s for the white colonists who were trying to colonize the United States, and they were fighting the American Indians. Mm. So it was this really reverse back thing, which was also happening in South Africa, incidentally, where you had black policemen.
Black army generals from Lesotho, Swaziland, Namibia, South Africa, going to assist the British.
Exactly. And even during the apartheid era, there were black conspirators that were involved in the oppression of the people in the township. So this kind of like divide and conquer thing has been going on for time immemorial. Mm. But this specific song was based on a speech that was written by a Pan-Africanist philosopher called Marcus Garvey in a speech that he delivered in Nova Scotia in 1937. And Bob Marley had heard about the speech and he even recited it at a concert that he was doing in 1979. But so it came from this consciousness and about moving Africanism forward. The Marcus Garvey was a Jamaican who believed in like trying to push the agenda and push, you know, civil rights movement forward already in the 1930s, which is like way ahead of the curve. I mean, the big civil rights movement was in the 1960s. Anyway, so Bob Marley was inspired by this, but actually the big inspiration, so the song was released in 1980. Mm. Bob Marley died in 1981 from cancer. Mm. He had been diagnosed with his cancer in 1977. And people are saying, well, people say that this is when the song emerged for the first time, where Bob Marley was reflecting a lot about like the morality of his life. Mm. And you hear it in the lyrics, you know, like the song is about a redemption. It's about moving forward, moving out of something. Mm. And he was reflecting on redemption and he was reflecting on his morality and his life. And he wrote the song in 1977 and only really emerged in 1980 on an album called Uprising, in which many of the songs had a religious tinge to it. Mm. Bob Marley clearly knew his life was coming to an end. Mm. And so he was reflecting on all of these things. And on this specific song, that is what he's talking about. Mm. He's talking about this reflection and probably preempting his passing, you know, as it would be in a few months' time. Incidentally, he died in 1981 in May, I think. And just 6 months earlier, in December, John Lennon died. Mm. So within the space of six months, there were these two iconic civil rights leaders who passed away and both happened to be musicians.
Yeah.
And I often reflect on the fact that we were around, well, I was around, I don't know about you.
I was
around at the time where there were these iconic like figures in historical figures like Bob Marley and John Lennon and Bishop Tutu and Nelson Mandela, like these iconic figures that shifted consciousness, shifted popular culture, shifted the way we think about things. Because I think prior to that, that wasn't happening. People weren't as switched on. And Bob Marley actually, when he died, he, because of his immense impact on politics in Jamaica, he got
he was huge.
Yeah, he got a a state funeral. So for a musician to get a state funeral, it means that what they have done is so significant that the government wants to recognize it. One of the big incidences was the Smile Jamaica concert, which was supposed to be, there were two warring factions in Jamaica at the time, and they decided to do this concert called Smile Jamaica, where they would try and unite the two factions, the two political parties. And 2 days before the concert, 2 days before the concert, Bob Marley was attacked at his house by members of the opposing faction to try and stop him from performing at the concert. He was shot. His wife, Rita Marley, was shot as well on the day. And his manager was shot. And they were in hospital. And they were dismissed from the hospital on the day of the concert. And Bob Marley, on that day, went to the concert, performed a 90-minute set. His wife was still in her gown from the hospital. They had just been dismissed. And they did the concert. After that, Bob Marley went into a self-imposed exile from Jamaica for 2 years. He lived in the Bahamas for a period of time and then moved on to the UK and eventually moved back to Jamaica, where they redid the concert. And this time they called it One Love.
Yeah.
And for the first time, these two warring factions united. And Bob Marley actually took the hands of the two leaders and united them at the concert, and it unified Jamaica for the first time in a very long time. And that is the power of music and the power of these people that, you know, like oftentimes people think that music is a frivolous activity and that it's just superficial candy floss. But so many people have changed the trajectory of history through music, and Bob Marley was one of those characters.
So the next character is both controversial, impactful, important, and I don't know how many other adjectives to add to her. Because this was also one very significant song. So say what you will about her, but she was also quite conscious about that moment that South Africa was going through. Brenda Fassie.
And I just heard an interview about a week or 2 weeks ago with Chico Twala talking about this song and a few other things that he did with Brenda Fassie. And the thing is that Chico Twala is himself a very controversial character, and there's been constant fighting between Chico and Bongani Fassie post Brenda Fassie's passing. But Brenda Fassie was the power that she is because she was a relatable character and someone that I think the people in the townships, I mean, she became a star at probably the height of apartheid, at like it's, you know, like people often say that the fire burns brighter before it's extinguished.
I think she's the only person publicly that was able to make Thabo Mbeki shy.
Yeah, but that was because she was shameless.
Exactly.
But that's what made her so.
I think she grabbed and kissed him. I must just remember. And I mean, you know, everybody's scared of him.
Oh, right.
But I think he
crumbled.
He was just shy, melting, all of the above.
Well, I mean, because on top of that, she was. And I think the thing is that she was a star at the height of apartheid. And I think a lot of black people in this country, they needed to look for something aspirational. And Brenda Fassie, although she was a big superstar, she was still relatable. She was still in the townships with the people. She wasn't. She didn't see herself as better than everybody else. She was a relatable person.
Yeah.
And so this specific song, Black President, was written about Nelson Mandela and his release from prison in 1990. And the song was actually released 2 days before he was released. So it was coincided perfectly with the release of Nelson Mandela in 1990.
Point of View.
Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.
Freedom. Yes. That's kind of the theme today, right?
Indeed.
Looking at human rights and that, that very powerful song by Brenda Fassie, Black President. Very, very impactful.
Yeah, and I think the thing with Brenda Fassie is that it's such, she's such a tragic figure and such a symptom of, I mean, whilst she was fighting for other people's rights, no one was fighting for her own rights.
This is it, she dies,
a pauper.
She wasn't free.
It's a very sad story that someone of that iconic status, and actually someone that was revered across the whole of Africa, not just in South Africa, she was an international star, could pass away in such a fashion. And I think oftentimes people give people what they think they want so that they can trap them. And I think that that's what happened with Brenda Fassie. Yeah. Like, just keep on feeding her the drugs and she'll keep on giving us what we want.
Yeah.
As long as she's happy and giving us music, we don't care how that happens.
So have you seen Tracy Chapman lately?
Oh, wow.
I have.
So this year, she was at the Grammy Awards because her song Fast Car was covered by a country musician.
Was number one or something?
Yes, it was covered by a country musician, went back to number one. And so she did like a cameo appearance with the singer, the country singer that did her song, redid her song. Mm. And she looked amazing.
She looked exactly like she looked when we last saw her.
Yes.
How many years ago is
except
that?
Except for maybe with
21
some gray
years.
Hair in her dreadlocks. She is such an amazing character because what I love about Tracy Chapman is that she's an unlikely superstar.
Yes.
Like a very quiet, unassuming individual. There's never been any major drama about her or controversy. She's just like done her thing. She plays her music. She brings her guitar with her. She does her thing and then she leaves. There's no drama, no harm, no foul, yet a very
amazing,
successful woman.
Yeah.
And the song that we're going to play is a song called Talking About a Revolution. And so this is actually quite, I got quite emotional, like reading up about the history of the song because, she wrote the song when she was 16 years old. Mm. And then the song only eventually came out in 1988 after she signed her first record deal with SBK. But so she was 16 years old and she came from quite a poor family. They were living in Cleveland and the mother didn't have lots of money and all of that stuff. And she got enrolled into a program whereby children of color in the United States are given scholarships to go study at prestigious private schools, and she won the scholarship to go and study at a prestigious private school in Connecticut. It was a boarding school, so she had to leave her home and move at the age of 16 to this new private school. And when she got there, and I often reflect on this because as someone who's in the schooling environment and often sees children that come into the environment that are not originally from that environment, the adjustment of those children in those spaces is tough because you're in a prestigious private school. Your friends are kids that have got mansions and Lamborghinis and Bentleys and all of that stuff, and they're going on European holidays. And this kid comes into this environment and there's not a chance that they can keep up with that because their parent is working at a diner somewhere, you know, like they're not going to be able to afford to keep up with that. And basically this song is about that. She went to the school, she got there, she met all these very privileged kids, and they didn't understand where she came from, how she was adjusting to the school. And she says they didn't care. They didn't care that she was from a poor background. They actually even felt that because she was from an impoverished background, there was no contribution that she could actually make. And that is why the song is called Talking About a Revolution, because she was like, I'm going to show people that I can do something and that I will start a revolution. And she wrote the song at the age of 16. And then what happened is she went to university, and at university there was a university radio station. And she negotiated a deal with the people at the radio station that they would record her demos and then play them on the radio station. So they had this deal where she would go record demos. Talking About a Revolution was one of those songs. And the song then, what happened was, One of the DJs was like, I love the song. And he knew someone at SBK and he smuggled the demo recording out and played it to the guy. And he was like, this is brilliant. Mm. They signed her to a deal. She had just finished her degree at the university and immediately got signed to a record deal. And her life was changed forever. And now she's an iconic musician.
Iconic. I mean, if there ever was one.
Exactly. Iconic. So, like, she flipped the story full circle. That voice.
That's absolutely banger. Michael Jackson, a really, really intriguing artist as well.
Yeah.
I mean, controversial doesn't begin to explain his career.
So we move from Tracy Chapman, who came from a very impoverished background.
Humble.
Yeah. To Michael Jackson, who did come from an impoverished background, but very quickly became a superstar.
And he was five. Yeah. So I don't think he remembers the poverty.
I don't think he understands.
Others, his older brothers, maybe. He doesn't remember the poverty.
No. There was, I mean, in Michael Jackson's mind, he was a superstar since he was five.
Yeah.
So obviously then in 1992, there's the child abuse allegations and all of that stuff. And his whole life changed. You know, like, he'd already been complaining about the fact that there was such a microscopic attention to everything that he did. He'd written a song in 1988 for the Bad album called Leave Me Alone, where he was like saying, it's enough, like, this whole thing. I mean, we can even reflect on the whole Princess of Wales story at the moment, where people are like, where is she? Middleton.
It's always tricky, right?
Yeah.
These conversations are tricky because of course he wants to stay the attention on him.
Yeah.
Of course he does.
Yes.
Of course, because those numbers translate into money.
Figures,
People coming to concerts.
Yeah.
You don't have that kind of attention.
Yeah.
It doesn't
translate.
The
people are not going to come.
Like, of course you want a cult following.
Exactly.
But I mean, you then complain about the cult following.
It's a double-edged sword.
So, yeah.
It's like you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this song, They Don't Really Care About Us, the History album, which came out in 1995, I don't think the record company really believed it was going to be a success. Mm-hmm. And that's why they made it a greatest hits. Plus, you get a whole new album attached to it. You know, it's like... They were hedging their bets. They were like, people will go buy a greatest hits by Michael Jackson, but are they going to go buy a whole brand new album by Michael Jackson? Mm. Let's just like slap that together and make it a big thing. Anyway, so that was the premise, I'm assuming, from the whole thing. Then he writes this song where he... It was a very angry album. I mean, the first single from the album
and the videos called, as well.
Yeah.
Very angry.
And so the first single was Scream, him and Janet Jackson, and they're very angry in that. And then They Don't Really Care About Us is like, he's very angry. And this song is specifically probably one of the most controversial songs that he ever had. When it was released, there was an outroar because of certain words that he used in the song, which were anti-Semitic and racist. And his argument was, I'm trying to say that I'm being persecuted like Jewish people. And so I'm just using it as a metaphor. I'm not using it to degrade Jewish people. What I'm doing is using the words to say I'm feeling as persecuted as the Jewish nation. And the word that he used was a K word for Jewish people. And I'm not going to say it because obviously it's so controversial.
Yes.
It's like the N-word, the K, South African K-word for black people, and it was a K-word for Jewish people. And he was like, I'm just using the word is I'm using it just to show how I'm being oppressed. And the Jewish community did not see it that way. They were like, just like white people can't use the N-word, you're not Jewish, you can't use that K-word. And so Michael Jackson didn't understand it initially, eventually apologized, went back into studio, re-recorded the song without the offending words, and offered that he would put an apology on all future records that were released, as the album as well as the single. The thing is that by that stage, Michael Jackson was so popular that already 2 million singles had already been sold. Mm. So those have become highly collectible. If you've got an original with the swear words in it, then it's highly collectible. But it's ironic because he was someone of privilege. He was someone who had come from a place where, you know, he was wanting for nothing.
Yeah.
And here he was talking about how he's being persecuted and how, you know, things are not fair. And that's what this song is about.
Point of View.
Monday to Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m.
All right, thanks so much for staying with us. The Human Rights Day today, and really looking forward to some of these. You're sending us some such lovely comments on X as well as on is it WhatsApp and X is Twitter. Yeah, and I'm very happy to also take your calls, 086-000-0959. I see Swoo's calling us from, are you in Kenilworth? Swoo, hi. Hello, Swoo.
Hi, Pamela, how's it?
I'm well, how are you?
Good, good. This has become my favorite show in radio, especially this feature.
Should we clap? We're going to clap for him.
Especially
Thanks,
this feature, yes.
Thanks,
Pamela, just to ask, any chance for an open session, like an open line, whether on Monday or on Tuesday? Is that even a possibility?
Like, what do you mean? Like, you talk about anything?
Yeah, general topics.
What do you want to talk about, Spook?
You'll just say it's an open line, whatever you want to voice.
Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. It does happen on other radio stations.
Yeah.
We'll see.
You'll think about it.
Yes, me and other people will have to think
You'll
about it.
You'll discuss it with the team.
Me, okay. Yes, me and the people that handle me, the person that answered your call and others.
Okay.
We'll obviously look at it. No, thank you. We'll think about that. We'll look into it, I promise you.
Back to the music. Mm-hmm. Struggle songs and freedom songs.
Yes.
A few points. Point number one, I hope you're going to play Tami Swamazai, Zabalaza, and Nizala Ngobani. Even though it was after the struggle era, but those were quite mm-hmm. big songs, you know, that were written and produced. Also, Miriam Makeba, when she was in exile, she played a very significant role in the South African struggle.
Mm-hmm.
There is a track on YouTube called Maibuye Africa mm-hmm. that she is performing live.
Mm-hmm.
I think also just to acknowledge the role that she played, I believe she even got banished from the state as well at some point, and she had to come to Africa and be in other African countries,
yes.
still advocating for our struggle in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to highlight that part. And
yes.
lastly, mm-hmm. Bob Marley, that song, No Woman, No Cry, mm-hmm. right? A lot of people, including myself, we misinterpreted that title, No Woman, No Cry. I thought it was saying, if there is no woman, there's nobody crying. No woman, no cry. But it actually says, in plain English, no woman, don't cry.
Mm-hmm.
But in a Jamaican way,
yes.
he put it as no woman, no cry.
Yeah. No, Swoo, thank you so much for your contribution. We'll look into the other songs that you've mentioned. We'll see what we can find.
Yeah. So
we'll try and find it very quickly for you. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Have a good one.
Thank you. Very interesting. We've had a conversation about Mera Makeba her contribution as well, right?
Yeah. And Mera Makeba, we've spoken a lot about. That's why I didn't choose another Mera Makeba song.
Because
I was like, we've already said how influential she was.
Yeah.
If she had not done what she had done, apartheid probably would have dragged on for a while longer.
Mm.
So she was very instrumental. And I mean, music was so powerful. And her music was so powerful. So she was a definite activist.
Mm.
You know, in her time.
Mm.
But also, I didn't want to do traditional struggle songs.
The obvious, maybe.
Yes, I wanted to do more like things where sometimes it's a personal struggle, you know.
Yes.
Sometimes it's not always about like the bigger picture. Sometimes it, like, for example, with the Tracy Chapman thing, it was more of a personal thing. But it's a personal struggle that many people go through.
Mm.
And incidentally, the last song, They Don't Really Care About Us, there's a South African link there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guitarists on the song is a guy called Trevor Rabin, a South African,
mm-hmm.
and the big guitar solo was by Slash from Guns N' Roses.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a South African playing guitar on that track as well. So,
yay!
Viva South Africa.
Sheldon always, you know, because you are a musician's musician.
Yes, you will
always, even if all I did was just clean the guitar player's shoes.
We're taking credit for that.
You're going to say, yes, there was a South African person just cleaning our shoes while we were playing the song.
So, but that's important.
Yes,
it is. Everyone's important in the creation process. Yeah. Our last song is a song by a guy called Labi Sifre,
mm-hmm.
Nigerian father and British mother of Afro-Barbadian mm-hmm. Heritage. And this song is also a personal struggle and very similar along the lines of Tracy Chapman. But he was inspired to write the song after watching a documentary about apartheid South mm-hmm. Africa. Mm-hmm. And he had actually gone into musical retirement, like a self-imposed retirement. He was 37 years old, and he was like, I'm done with this music business. Mm. So he started a career in the music industry in the 1970s. He was a formally trained musician, started in 1970, and then by like 1982, he was done with it. And so he'd been in retirement for about 3 years, 1985. He saw the documentary in 1982, where he saw like white South African policemen shooting black civilians in South Africa, and he was so outraged that he was like, I'm going to write a song about this. Mm. And he wrote the song Something Inside So Strong. But it wasn't only about that apartheid documentary that he saw. It was also about being a black male homosexual in the United Kingdom, not accepted, being bullied at school. All of those things came to the fore when he started writing this composition, and it all materialized in this song. And initially what he was going to do was he was going to give it to somebody else to record. He didn't want to record it himself because he was retired. He had left the music industry. And then he was convinced to record the song. And it was his first top 10 hit in the UK. So he'd been in the industry for 17 years when the song was released, and he'd never had a top 10 hit. And this was his top 10 hit. And it just goes to prove that, like, there's no time limit on talent. Mm. It can happen at any time, and it can happen when you least expect it. And he, I don't think, was expecting that this was going to happen at this time in his career. Mm. And he released the song. And actually, the song became so much more poignant for me when I went to go watch Lira perform at Gold Reef City. And she performed the song, and I started crying because I was like, this is such a beautiful song. And I was reminded of the song that I'd heard so many years before. And not knowing that it had all of that significance, but sitting there, I could feel that emotion coming from the songwriter. Mm. All of those things, the apartheid, the bullying at school, that all of those elements came forward without him having to actually communicate it in lyrics.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.